You're listening to Plague Talk, the podcast that owes its existence to COVID-19. Where? Because we suddenly have a lot more time on our hands and worry on our minds, we talk with anybody who dares about the old normal, the new normal, strategies, epiphanies, hopes, and fears, and what we want normal to look like when and if it's all over. Because who says we have to go back to all the things that were broken and wrong before? Our guest is Nancy Mosser of Pittsburgh casting fame. Nancy has been a pillar of the regional film and television industry for three decades, starting in 1990 with TV movie Criminal Justice and plowing right through to lockdown with the 2020 productions Dear Zoe and I'm Your Woman. Here's a catalog of just a few of the movies and television projects for which she has served as local, extras, and or location casting director. Ma Rainey's Black Bottom, Escape at Dannemora, American Pastoral, Fathers and Daughters, Me and Earl and the Dying Girl, for which Nancy and her longtime assistant Katie Chanot won a coveted Artius Award, Scott Cooper's Out of the Furnace, The Perks of Being a Wallflower, One for the Money, The Next 3 Days, Love and Other Drugs, The Road, Adventureland, Zack and Miri Make a Porno, The Mothman Prophecies, Wonder Boys, Inspector Gadget, Dogma, Kingpin, Diabolique, not the original, Sudden Death, The Piano Lesson, The Cemetery Club, and too many more to try to squeeze in during allergy season. Nancy cast me in my first motion picture, and from the moment I draped myself across her casting couch, has always been a source of encouragement, direction, and general goodness. We discuss her showbiz origin story, career highlights, ups and downs, and how the industry has changed over the course of 30 years. Then we take the conversation viral and talk about how COVID-19 has affected the regional film and television world, how it has altered Nancy's personal life, and the effect upon the world we all share, and the ways in which it may have changed in a more permanent way. All of the above. Nancy Mosser, welcome to Plague Talk.
Hi, Jack.
I'm going to get right into it. You've been a casting director in the region for, is it 27 years or 30?
I haven't counted, but 1990.
1990, 30. That would be 30 years.
Yeah.
Got 90 casting credits on IMDb. You've cast at least 800,000 commercials.
At least.
And won the, I'm not sure how to say it, Artios Award for Best Location Casting in 2017 for Me and Earl and the Dying Girl.
Yes, it's Artios, actually, so.
Artios, there you go.
You want to say that again, you can.
Artios. So, 30 years. Are you ready to cash in your camcorders and ride into the sunset?
No, I am not. And I've really discovered how much I love it and that I'm not retiring anytime soon during this pandemic because I really miss it. I miss the actors. I miss the interaction. I miss seeing how they, you know, practice their craft and do such a wonderful job and really put themselves out there for each role. And I really miss it.
Is it more fun when somebody comes in for the first time and you have no idea what they're going to put out there and get to see who they are? Or is it more fun when you've known them for years and they come in to do something that you've never seen them do before? Or are they just equally delightful?
They're both delightful, but I do really enjoy seeing my friends come in and do their work. But I realize also that many times that's the only time that I see the actors. Either they're on stage or they're auditioning for me. And I rarely see them outside of that environment. And in a way, I sort of wish that I think that I would like to get to know the actors better than I have. And that's one thing. Another thing that I've learned during this pandemic is that we really need to connect more. And I'd like to do that with actors because they're my people. I grew up with a theatrical family and attended my parents' plays and performed in my parents' plays. And my mother was an actress and a choreographer. Wow. And my dad directed. And I used to do my homework watching them rehearse.
What are your parents' names?
Pardon me?
What are their names?
They were Faye and Al Mosser. And I realized that because of what I do, actors tend to be different than when they're around me than if they were away, if I weren't a casting director. Do you know what I mean?
Yeah, of course. They don't know that you're from a show business family, probably.
Right. And I think that, you know, they're worried that I'm always judging them. And actually, I just like to be around them.
Yeah, that's you. That problem is magnified in Los Angeles because any party that you go to where there are actors and other industry people, I feel like everybody's always on performing.
Exactly.
Because they feel like they're still being watched for a potential role. And maybe they are, but it's a shame that they can't let down their hair.
That's really true. And so I think that I would really like to, going forward, get to know people outside of those conditions a little better.
Have you thought about having like a potluck that's a no networking gathering?
I think that's a great idea. I would like to do that.
There's so little sense of community in Los Angeles that I, you know, was thinking if I had my own place, I would like to do that maybe once a fortnight, just bring a group of people that I think are spectacular together. And that's the rule. You can bring a guitar and play, you can bring this and that, but it's just a night of fun, no networking.
That's a great idea.
Relax, you know.
Exactly.
Everybody says, what do you do for work in LA? Nobody says, what do you do for fun?
That's true. Yeah. That's interesting.
So how'd you get into casting?
It was sort of a long road, but I started in college at Penn State as a theater major. Mm. I didn't really know what I wanted to do, except I knew that I loved being around the theater. So I started there. But I quickly realized, and maybe it was just a bad acting teacher, but I quickly realized that I didn't have the passion that you need to study acting to be an actor. I really think that actors work at it every single day. They devote their lives to it. And I didn't really feel that passion. I wanted to do other things also. Mm-hmm. And at the time at Penn State, if you wanted to be an actor, you had to build sets for 4 years. And maybe when you were a grad student, you got to perform. Wow. And so I think that that was part of it. And also the other acting majors sort of made fun of you if you wanted to go to a football game or do anything else besides it. Yeah, it was sort of like,
Very cliquish and tribal.
Exactly. And, you know, I'm glad that I realized that. So I switched to television production. I discovered that I cut through a building in the dead of winter at Penn State, and it was snowing and cold and miserable. And I cut through a building just to warm up on the way to class. And I peeked into the TV studio and thought, that looks like a lot of fun.
Wow.
So I took a course and loved it and switched to TV production. When I graduated, I got a job at Channel 11 in Pittsburgh.
I want you to realize what a delicious metaphor that is. Just coming in out of the cold, and you were kind of feeling some cold in the coursework too, and the treatment from the other students because you had other interests and didn't want to build sets for 4 years. You come in to get out of the cold, and you find something that's warming to your mind and your soul, more welcoming than where you've been too.
It's pretty
exactly.
Cool.
Sorry.
It really is. And I got my first job at Channel 11 in Pittsburgh, and I'll turn my phone off. Okay. I'll start again. I got my first job at Channel 11 in Pittsburgh when it was WIIC-TV, and just as a production assistant. And during that time, I met the director of Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood. His wife worked at Channel 11, and they asked me to come over to be one of his assistants. And I left Channel 11 and went to Mr. Rogers.
Wow.
But Mr. Rogers' Neighborhood, which was an amazing experience, they only produced 15 shows a year.
Is that right?
So in between the actual production, they would lay everybody off. So I had to find other work. And in doing that, I found work as an AD, and then I found work as a director, and did local commercials and corporate projects and things like that. And then people started to ask me if I could do casting or find extras or find actors for these projects. And I started to do that and realized how much that I loved that aspect of production. Mm. And luckily, I had the opportunity to interview for an extras casting position on a film that was shooting in Pittsburgh for HBO called Criminal Justice. And I loved it and worked about, you know, 12 or 13 hours a day.
Yep.
In that job.
Yep.
Or I'm sorry, I worked 23 hours a day in that job because it was in the days where there were no cell phones, there were no emails.
Yeah.
You had to call every single extra and tell them where to go and what to bring and what to wear. And I absolutely loved it. I absolutely loved it. And I said, this is what I want to do. And from there, I started doing speaking parts. People called me and said, can you do speaking parts? And I said, sure, I can. And I figured out how to do that. And I've been doing that ever since. It took me about 11 years in production before I started to specialize in casting.
So how do you keep that pace? How do you stay up for 22 hours in a row, more than one day?
Part of it was that I just absolutely loved it so much. You know, I was 31 years old and I had lots of energy, and I just absolutely loved it. And I really didn't have any choice. You know, I started out with no pictures of anyone, and I had to cast about 1,200 extras in that show.
Good God.
So, you know, I literally had to be up doing that. Plus, you know, movie making changes, as you know, so quickly that, you know, you could get a word at 11 o'clock at night that you need more people or fewer people or different people the next day because of weather or other issues. So that's just the way it is. But, you know, again, in those days, people had to be home to get a phone call.
Yeah.
So,
yes. Right. You know, a little later, they had a pager and you'd have to run to a phone.
No, that's true.
Yeah, I remember I kept a voicemail box with a New York number or something like that for a while.
Right.
So I could pretend I was there.
But, you know, it's sort of, it was amazing training in what I did because it was extremely hands-on. And you got to know the people. And I went to set almost every day and signed people in also. So I got to see both, be part of both worlds. I got to be on set and I got to be in the office. And as long as people showed up and the director was happy, you could work whatever hours that you needed to.
So that's an aspect of that used to be in the purview of casting directors and now belongs to PAs, assigning people in. Or are you doing both, like PA work and casting director work?
It's funny. I didn't realize that I really didn't have to be there every day. another thing we did then, I'm glad you reminded me, is that we paid the extras in cash.
Oh.
At the end of the day. So I had to be there at the beginning of the day, whether it be 4 a.m.
Right.
Whatever. And then I had to be there at wrap 12 or 14 hours later to pay the extras.
God. And then they had to sort out their taxes themselves.
Well, right. I think after that, the government got involved and said, wait a second. You can't do that.
We're not getting as much as we calculated we should. Yeah.
Right. But I remember that one of my extras who was in the show a lot, and he was this big guy. And, you know, sometimes I'd have $3,000 worth of cash in my fanny pack that I wore back then. And he said, Nance, I'll come and protect you at sign up. And I said, that would be great. So he did. And I'd give him, you know, some cash to do that. And he would also show up every day with about 10 guys, knowing full well that people don't show up every day. And he'd say, I have 10 guys that are ready to work. And I'd usually hire him. So he did both those jobs for me. And one of the stars of the film was Forrest Whitaker. And this guy, Jerome, became a stand-in and a photo double for Forrest Whitaker.
This guy was a hustler.
He was. And after the show, he went to other cities with Forrest Whitaker to stand in. He got his SAG card. You know, it became a thing for a while for him. And I really appreciated his hustle.
Became part of the casting society. He got his SAG card. He ran a protection racket.
Exactly.
So he sounds very Teamster to me.
He's a good guy.
So what else? That's your first monster project in Criminal Justice.
It was. It starred Rosie Perez, Whitaker, as I mentioned, Anthony LaPaglia.
Oh, yeah.
Those are the people I remember, and that started my career in casting.
Did you get to meet Forrest?
I did. What a wonderful guy.
I figured, yeah. I've never met him. I love his work, yeah.
Yeah, he was, you know, fairly unknown then, and he would go up on the hill and go to jazz clubs and hang out with the locals, and he, you know, really became entrenched in the city of Pittsburgh, and they loved him.
I heard an adorable story from the producer, maybe director of Fast Times at Ridgemont High. I think that was his first role. He played the quarterback, and he came in for the audition. He was very serious. He did it. He nailed it. She told him, I think, there and then, we want you. We want you for the role. And he, you know, very, very quietly and without affects, said, okay, cool. Okay, when do I show up? And then she happened to glance out the window about 5 minutes later, and she saw him in the parking lot skipping to his car.
That's a great story.
who've been some of your highlight directors and producers?
Oh, boy. I've had the opportunity to work for some really wonderful people. Steve Chbosky, who directed Perks of Being a Wallflower.
Yeah, and wrote it, right?
And wrote it, yeah. Wrote the book, wrote the script, directed. He's a Pittsburgh guy.
I forget
from
that.
Hills of Pittsburgh. And it was really neat because I did a FaceTime interview with him. And he said to me, "You have been a touchstone in my life." And how, Steve? And he said, "Because my sister is an actress. And I've heard from her and a lot of actors in Pittsburgh that you are very respectful and supportive of actors. So you're the person that I want to work with."
Yeah, he's right. You have a very nurturing presence and process and atmosphere. It's not always the case.
I've heard that. Yeah. And when I watch movies and TV shows and they have casting directors in the show, they always depict them as being sort of crass and blunt and eating in front of them and talking on the phone in front of actors when they're trying to audition and things like that.
I thought that was supposed to be the producer sitting in on the casting.
Maybe, but I really try to create a very supportive atmosphere in my sessions, because when actors do well, the producers thank me for doing a great job, right?
Yeah.
So I don't know why people wouldn't do that.
Yeah. It's probably partly a personality trait and part of your code, you know.
It's true. It really is the way I am. And I really can't do anything about that. I'm a very supportive person in general, but it really does help. And, you know, I try to do that with all of my sessions.
So Chbosky was a definite highlight.
He was. He was so kind and so supportive in his own right. And it was interesting because when I heard that this film was coming to Pittsburgh, my stepdaughter, who was in college at the time, called me up and she said, "You have to work on this film." And I said, "Why?" She said, "Because this book that this film is based on changed my life, saved my life when I was in high school." And I heard this from many, many people after that.
Wow.
And so when Steve Chbosky was, you know, walking around Pittsburgh looking for locations, people would come up to him and say that to him. They weren't interested really in seeing the stars of the film as much as they were in meeting him.
Yeah, absolutely. Right. And in seeing the story rather than the stars.
And one time, it was towards the end of filming, we were shooting at a football field in the South Hills. And I stopped on set just to make sure everything was going okay and help out. Steve Chbosky spotted me in the middle of setting up this big scene. And he came up to me and stood right inches from my face and said, "You are doing an incredible job. You have done everything that I needed. I am so happy with your work." And I just started to cry. You know? I started to tear up. And it was incredible moment that he took that time and, you know, so appreciative. So,
and he's right, but what a sweetheart. Yeah.
What a sweetheart. And then a few years ago, he came to Pittsburgh, to the University of Pittsburgh, to do a talk. And I went to see him. And I sat in the audience, and he spotted me at one time. And he just stopped and he said, "Nancy Mosser's here. She's a great casting director. And I'm so glad to see you." And then there were many people in the audience that had been in the film as extras, and they each gave their little testimonies about it. And it was, again, another amazing moment because he took the time to reach out. So he was great. It was really fun working with Kevin Smith.
Yeah.
I worked with Kevin two times.
Oh, what? So Dogma, I know. What else?
Dogma and Doc and Mary Make a Porno.
Right.
When I worked on Dogma, I was doing the extras casting. And we were in a meeting, just going over the breakdown of the extras, how many people, what they should look like, all kinds of, you know, specs on them. And he said to me, there was a part of the governor of New Jersey, one of the scenes, and he said, there was somebody else that was supposed to do it. I think it was Elizabeth Ashley was supposed to play the role, and she dropped out. And he said to me, do you act? And I said, yes. And he said, do you want to be the governor of New Jersey?
Yeah.
And I said, sure. And I had just, right before that, I had just gotten my hair cut really short, and it looked really businesslike for the first time. I usually have really long hair, and I think I just looked the part to him right at that moment. So I got to do this role, and I stood next to George Carlin all day, which was an amazing experience in itself.
Did he talk?
Yeah, he talked to me. He was extremely professional. He was extremely focused. He did not utter a swear word, which people think he swears a lot. He really doesn't in person. Mm-hmm. He did in his routines, but he did not. And after we were finished with the scene, he was released. He came back over to me after walking away, came back to me and said, it was great working with you. Mm. And it was an amazing moment. I also had 350 extras on set that day that I was responsible for. A lot of people didn't show up. It was one of those crazy days where the marching band that was in the scene got lost. The entire marching band was lost in Pittsburgh.
Wow.
It was very stressful.
That is the antithesis of a good marching band.
Yeah. Exactly. Wow. But they finally showed up. One time we did a take, and it was a scene where Matt Damon and Ben Affleck come up and interrupt this speech. The Cardinal, George Carlin played the Cardinal. Mm-hmm. They interrupt this speech, and a police officer gets killed in the scene.
Mm.
And everybody screams and runs.
Mm.
So, you know, our job was to scream and run. George and I were to run up these stairs, and the marching band was behind us. There were a bunch of nuns in the shot. And this high school kid with a big drum, these big drums, what are they called?
Bass drum.
He turned. George was running up the stairs, and the kid turned and he knocked George Carlin over.
Oh.
He didn't completely fall. I helped catch him.
Yeah.
And I grabbed this kid and I said, don't you ever do that again.
Whoa.
Caught
George by the ponytail.
I knocked down the star. But anyway, it was...
You've broken an icon.
I know. It was crazy. It was crazy, crazy, and crazy wonderful.
So you've made another appearance. At least one other appearance I know of in film, too. Right. What was that like?
That was in Out of the Furnace.
Yeah.
Scott Cooper directed that. Another wonderful guy to work with. We did the speaking parts and the extras on that. I auditioned lots of women for the screaming woman at the drive-in.
Mm-hmm.
That was the name of the role.
Right.
Many actresses. I didn't really know what he was looking for. He didn't really tell me exactly...
Mm-hmm.
what this person's motivation was, what she was like,
mm-hmm.
too much. So I played it a bunch of different ways with the actors, and they did a great job. And one day I was homesick while I was working on the film, and Scott Cooper called Katie, my assistant. He said, is Nancy act? And she said, yes, she has. And he said, because I'm thinking of making her the screaming woman at the time.
Wow.
So I have
He'd never seen you scream?
No.
Right. Huh.
He never had. And I remember, it was so funny, I ran into him in downtown Pittsburgh the night before I was supposed to do this role. And just on the street, hi, Scott. He was walking along with Casey Affleck, mm-hmm. looking at some fireworks that were happening across the river at PNC Park.
Mm-hmm.
And he said, are you ready? And I said, what are you going to have me do? And he said, you'll see. Talk about pressure.
Mm-hmm.
So that night, there were 300 extras at a drive-in scene with their cars,
mm-hmm.
all the crew, everybody.
Mm-hmm. Yeah, it's a big...
Got me all dressed in like khaki pants, real suburban looking mm-hmm. woman. And I met my stunt guy husband. They sort of told me what I was going to do. They didn't mic me or anything.
Wow.
And Woody Harrelson arrived in character.
Mm-hmm.
We did a little rehearsal.
Mm.
He sort of looked at me like, wonder what she's gonna do. But we did a rehearsal and then they just rolled. And he said, just scream bloody murder, tell him stop, just say stop, or however you would say it. And I did. And all the stress of coming through for this director who had never seen me do anything, having the entire crew there watching, all the extras, I really used that in my screaming.
Yeah.
Like, there is no way I'm going to let these people down. And I did it. And Katie came running over after and she said, Nancy, I have goosebumps. And the producer came running over. He said, you're a casting director and you can scream like that? And I said, yes, I can, I guess. And I had never screamed like that in my life. So I didn't really have anything to go on. But yeah, again, just an amazing experience. Adrenaline was running. We did it a bunch of different times.
Right.
And one of the times he said, okay, add somebody call 911. So I did that. But one time one of the extras was directed to come over and towards me. And I grabbed this, during the take, I grabbed the extra's arm. Mm-hmm. And I said, you have a cell phone. And he looked at me like, is this you, Nancy, asking me? Is this real? What am I supposed to do? Am I
right,
supposed
right, to right. Aw, yeah.
It was so adorable.
Yeah.
And we were supposed to do two nights, but after like the eighth take, the crew, the AD announced that the film was wrapped. We were done with the film.
And Scott, and I heard you said he got up and got up on a truck with a bullhorn.
He did. Scott Cooper got up and he thanked the crew and said it was the next to his wedding and the birth of his children. It was the most wonderful experience of his life. And it was an incredible moment because nobody had been released yet. All the extras were there looking up at him, all the crew. And this, you know, summer night in Pittsburgh, and it was a wonderful ending.
Yeah. Perfect moment.
It really was. And I usually don't put myself in films, but sometimes, you know, when a director asks you to do something, you do it. And I'm really glad that I had that opportunity.
Well, you've got to add Scream Queen to your resume now.
I guess so.
You screamed as the governor, ran up the stairs, running, screaming, catching icons as they fall. Yeah.
That is so true. I didn't think of that.
Yeah, and anything can happen on a set, particularly with a big, big cast, lots of extras.
It's really true. It was really fun, and I could see how actors like doing this thing, for sure.
So I'm going to jump on a different, on a related ship. You're a big advocate, and your assistant, Katie, I believe, is a board member of the Pennsylvania Film Industry Association, PAFIA, or as I call it, the PAFIA.
Right, right.
What is their mission?
Well, their mission is to make sure that film workers are represented in the state, because there's many times where they're trying to get a film tax credit passed and things like that that help film workers. And I think that it was originally designed for people to have a voice, because it's not a union, but I think that if legislators realize that there are a group of people that have this interest, then they'll pay attention. So that's why it started. And it was a way for film people that work in the film business to assemble and have a voice.
So it's a big focus on the film tax program, but also just a focus on being unified in bringing production work here and connecting people in the industry with people in politics or people people who can get something done.
Right. And, you know, as I said before, usually you don't see people that work in the business unless you're actually working.
Yeah, right.
Not outside of work. So that's been a good thing too. And the film tax credit in Pennsylvania is so important because we are competing with a lot of other states that also have the same benefits to
what is it? What is a film tax program?
What it is there is a certain amount of money that is allotted to producers in the form of tax credits. So if they bring a film here, they hire a certain number of people, they spend a certain amount of money, then they get that money back in tax credits.
They get all the money that they spend in tax credits, or the money that they spend in taxes, or up to a certain. So any money that they spend in state, they get back as a tax credit.
Well, I think it's a certain number.
Okay. Yeah. I know there's a cutoff, right? That's not, it's not infinite.
$70 million is dispersed per year, but that's throughout the whole entire state of Pennsylvania.
Oh.
So we're also, Southwestern PA is also competing with Philadelphia and other areas of the state that are making films. And this all started in the United States because Canada had a, what they called an arts grant that they would give to productions that filmed there. So a lot of productions were moving out of, especially
was
out of
that, California. Was that why the...
That's why. Huh. Especially out of California into Canada.
Mm-hmm.
And then, you know, California started to fight back with tax credits, and then other states started to implement them. And now productions and producers are so used to getting tax credits that they'll literally leave a state if they can't get it.
Huh.
And that is why it's so important now for filmmaking in Pennsylvania.
So it's become a, they've gotten used to it. The kind of it's, they demand it now.
Absolutely.
And, so, and expect it.
Yes. In fact, we almost lost Perks of Being a Wallflower because of the tax credit issue. But luckily, somehow they figured out how to get one here in Pennsylvania.
Mm-hmm.
It would have been a crime for Steve Chbosky not to be able to shoot that film here.
Mm-hmm.
But it definitely could have happened. And states like Georgia, especially Georgia, who has an uncapped tax credit, meaning any film that comes there gets a tax credit, some form of a tax credit.
Mm-hmm.
They, because of this, they have built studios and this incredible infrastructure in Georgia to lure productions there. And when Pittsburgh usually has 1 to 3 productions at once, Georgia has 35 productions.
Right.
Same time. So they really sort of understood what it could do for the state.
So there, they've built a lot of infrastructure to keep films coming, or to keep them there, to keep production companies there as often as possible. Do we have that here? Are we working on having that here?
Well, that's sort of a catch-22.
Okay.
And that's why Georgia has been able to develop all this infrastructure, is because they have this uncapped tax credit. So people know that they can shoot there, and they can shoot there in the future.
Mm-hmm.
And Pennsylvania, because it is capped, there's a limit. So I think that a lot of people don't want to spend a huge amount of money building studios and other, you know, infrastructure, if they don't know if they're going to be able to use it or rent it out or get their money, you know, make their money back on this, you know, investment. So that is something that sort of held up companies from building a large infrastructure here. Another thing is the weather in Georgia is really a lot better all year than it is in Pennsylvania. So I think that has a part of it. You know, that's part of it too. You know, if you're going to shoot a winter movie, you know, we can do that here in the winter, but it's sort of hard to shoot, you know, a sunny blue sky film in the winter in Pittsburgh.
Yes,
so indeed. I think that's also part of it.
Yeah, I think if I may play devil's advocate for a moment, I understand that when films come, then production people here get to work and eat, and that they put a certain amount of money into the economy. And I have heard conflicting studies on, and it'd be difficult to do the study, because I think there are also different kinds of tax credits for film as well. Two different, one's more of the investment in an area type, and the other is just they get a credit, and there are transferable credits as well, right? Where you can take them back to another state with you, take the money back to another state that you get in credits.
Right. They can sell the credits too. I don't really understand how all that works, but that is part of it also.
What objective evidence is there that a state film tax credit is economically beneficial in the long term? Do you know of any independent studies that have analyzed the cost benefit ratio?
Well, the Pittsburgh Film Office hired a company to do a study to try to quantify what filmmaking brings into a city. And right. I guess that's not considered completely independent for sure, but they did do a very large study. I think it's hard to quantify, but, you know, when you think of these productions coming into town and how much money they spend on sets and hotels, and every crew person gets per diem, so they spend money here with their cash per diem, and then caterers and extras and actors. I mean, there's so many people are hired when one film comes to town that I just really don't understand why it wouldn't be a benefit.
Yeah, it's certainly a boon for the local cast and crews and hotels and lots of other people for the period that they're here.
I think that people in other areas of the state, like in the central part of Pennsylvania where they don't get big films, I think that they're the people that really complain about the tax credit.
I wonder now that we've spoiled the film industry a bit with the tax credit and acclimated them to having it, if it doesn't become a bidding war that in the end could cut some of our own throats. But it's difficult when you have a place like Georgia having an uncapped, so they're taking a lot of work that might be coming here, at least a substantial amount of work that might be coming here and going to other places. Right. So to be competitive, you feel like you have to try to reach an unlimited or an uncapped. But I wonder when you get to that point if it's still profitable for the state.
Well, Georgia seems to think so, and they just keep going with it. So I'm sure that if it were not profitable, they wouldn't do it. I think a lot of people too think that the money's going to Hollywood.
Yes.
You know what I mean? And not to the people here in Pennsylvania. Mm. And that is really not true. Right. And then, you know, there's tax credits for oil and gas and other yes. kind of industries too. And that's also part of it. I think the Pittsburgh Film Office used to be partially funded by the tourism, Pennsylvania tourism. Mm. And I think that should be part of it, because every actor in every film that's shot here, the actors do a tour promoting these films, and they always talk about the city where they shot it.
Yeah, the city always seems to figure pretty prominently, almost always in anything that's shot here, right?
Right. And so when Tom Hanks goes on, you know, late night TV and national TV and talks about Pittsburgh and what a great place it is and why, that promotes the state. So I think that people need to realize that that's a huge impact too when people film here.
Yeah, Pittsburgh is a beautiful and a great town. We need to get the air pollution down. That's probably happened some now just under lockdown.
No, that's true.
It will be perfect. from a Berg's eye view, how has the film industry changed over the past 30 years?
Well, productions really started here, and crews started to be trained by George Romero when he started making films here.
Mm.
Like Night of the Living Dead and all the zombie films.
Right.
And so there were films being made here way before the tax credit. And the fact that there were wonderful crews that were trained here, wonderful actors, an easy place to shoot, a less expensive place to shoot than places like New York City, then that's where the real infrastructure started in Pittsburgh.
Mm-hmm.
And in the 90s, we got really busy with films and TV shows, no tax credit then. Then it's sort of the unions and other big cities didn't like it too well, and they started to disrupt filmmaking here for a while.
It did dry up for a while. Was that part of it?
It did.
How would they manage to pull that off?
Well, I think that they were, you know, pretty powerful unions, and they, you know, disrupted as much as they could. And so filmmakers were hesitant to come in because of the disruption. Mm-hmm. But since then, the unions here have been really great in negotiating and working with producers, and somehow we've made it good again.
Is that partly because there's just such a glut of projects right now? There's so much material for all of the streaming networks and the streaming and the cable.
I think so. There's so much content that we need to fill all these networks and streaming sites, and I think there's enough to go around, I guess. I'm not quite sure why, but luckily we've been able to keep going here in Pennsylvania.
Yeah. How many concurrent or shooting in tandem, how many movies or television show and or television shows do you think we'd have to have running to keep every cast and crew member in show business in the region working?
Oh, that's a good question.
Has there been a time where it felt like that was the case, where just about everybody in production had a gig?
The past couple of years, there have been TV shows shooting at the same time. Last summer, I was working. I did two movies at once in the fall and one in the summer. So that was three just for my company alone. So I think that if we have 3 to 5 at once, that's great.
That's enough.
And everybody's working. Now, for a while, we had a couple of years ago, we had trouble with our state budget. It wasn't passed at the end of June like it usually is. Mm-hmm. And so there were no productions for 6 or 7 months. And a lot of people had to leave. A lot of crew people left, went to Atlanta. So they
because of the budget not having been passed. What was the holdup? Do you remember?
I don't remember what it was. It was a, you know, political battle between Democrats and Republicans about something.
Well, there's a surprise.
But it really, you know, sort of held everything up. But luckily, my company works on commercials, so we kept going with those.
Good. So paint us a picture of an average day in the life of Nancy Mosser before lockdown.
Before lockdown. Well, before lockdown, let's say in the fall, we were working on 2 films. One was called Dear Zoe, and one was called I'm Your Woman.
Yeah.
And I would have auditions for speaking parts on one show in the morning and another show in the afternoon. Mm. And then Katie Chanel, my other casting director, has been with me for 17 years now. She would be working on prepping the extras for the shows, booking extras. But also we would be doing auditions for commercials at the same time. So we were working long days then. And I have another person that helps me, freelancer, that helps me do my website and posting and editing auditions and things like that, some of the busy work so I can concentrate on the other things. And he was working away. So that's usually what we would be doing during the day, talking to the producers and directors about different roles and different actors. Doing deal memos for the actors.
You're busy, checking. Sounds like.
Yeah. So all those kinds of things. We check their status with the Screen Actors Guild to make sure everybody are members or have paid their dues and things like that. So those kinds of things. A lot of busy work too, but
What happens with an actor who shows up who's lapsed? They show up on the day and you find out that they're getting ready to go on and the report comes through from SAG. No, they lapsed a while ago.
Luckily, I haven't had that happen lately.
Yeah.
I do remember one of my first movies we shot here. It was called Money for Nothing. We shot in Pittsburgh and then we moved to Philly and there were union extras there. And I sort of learned what that's all about.
Huh.
What happens is the production will get fined if an actor didn't pay their dues.
Mm.
And that, you know, that can happen. But, you know, part of our job is to check to make sure that the actors do pay. There are times where, you know, we have to be on the phone with the actors saying, are you down at the Screen Actors Guild office? Did you write them a check? Have you paid your dues? And we have a receipt to prove that. And sometimes we're calling Los Angeles because it's after hours here in Pittsburgh to make sure that happens. And it's very important that actors pay their dues. I always remind them about that.
Yep.
Because otherwise it causes a lot of stress.
Goodness, yeah. Do the actors get fined themselves?
Okay. We do.
Yeah, sorry.
The actors definitely get a scolding from SAG, but I don't know about that.
Yeah. They'll probably let go. I don't know.
I don't know.
The film can let them go. If it's less of an expense to let them go than to keep them.
Right.
When did you realize we were in for a crisis unparalleled in our lifetime?
This is interesting because I was out in Los Angeles at the end of January. We got nominated again for an RDS award for Escape at Dannemora for Showtime.
Great show.
I'm really happy I got to do that because little did I know everything was going to shut down after. But I was there in January and we started hearing about people on cruise ships and other places with this virus. And a lot of people had masks on and we were sort of aware of it, but we just went about our business. You know, we had this big event at Beverly Hilton and we went out to dinner and we were playing pickleball and, you know, doing all the fun LA things to do.
Pickleball.
So, you know, we just had a great vacation and, you know, visited relatives and things like that. And my husband came to join me. And then when we got back to Pittsburgh, we were just, you know, going about our usual lives. And the week everything sort of came to a screeching halt. I had on March 10th, 100 actors come through my space to audition for a commercial. And we also, Thursday the 12th, had a callback. And I had a callback that usually would involve a director, a producer from an advertising agency, creative director from an advertising agency, maybe a writer, to pick their final selects for a commercial. And a few days before, we got word that the director did not want to fly in from New York, producer did not want to fly in from Chicago because they were worried about the virus. But the local people came, a couple of the local producers came, but I went out the night before and bought some disinfectant for the office. And when I did that, I found an empty shelf in the grocery store. And I was like, this is something, people really, something's going on here. And I happened to find some, they were all out of the Clorox type things, but they had some natural, more natural kind of products. So I grabbed them. And that day we were disinfecting door handles and things like that as we went along. Actors still came into the room and tried to shake hands with people. That's sort of a natural thing. And, or, you know, the director would stand, it was, I guess, a producer would stand up and, you know, people had to be reminded not to do that.
Yeah.
Right. You know, you had to say, oh, sorry, I can't shake your hand. And it was weird. And, but the actors didn't seem too nervous about it. It was sort of, people were subdued, I thought, in the room. The clients were subdued. One of the clients was worried that he wouldn't be able to take his son to Disneyland. He got tickets to go and he was worried about that. And there was definitely a feeling that something was up.
Yeah.
But you know, we went through our day. That also that week, a friend of mine came in from California and we all went to dinner that same week. And March 10th, we all went to dinner and and I even remarked about the fact that he couldn't even get a parking space in the parking lot. The restaurant was packed.
Was this before or after the empty shelf incident?
It was 2 days before. Sorry. That was 2 days before.
Okay.
And I even remarked about the fact, I said, wow, it's a hockey night in Pittsburgh. You know, there was hockey, Pittsburgh Penguins were playing on the big screens and everybody was eating and talking and laughing. And I said, well, I guess people aren't worried about it here.
Yeah.
And that was March 10th. And then by March 12th is when we were starting to use the disinfectant that I found, the little bits that I found.
A couple days later.
When everybody left that day, I literally cleaned off my desk, took everything that I needed home.
Yeah.
And that was it. Everything shut down the next day.
Yeah. It's the empty shelf visual is a cinematic moment.
It really was.
It speaks volumes. I had a similar experience. I went into a Coons. And as often is the case, I had the exact wrong thought at first because I saw in the refrigerated or frozen section all of these empty shelves, not just the disinfectant because it was the first rush on the hoarding, first rush on supplies. And I thought, oh, they're expecting people to shelter at home to the point that they're not even restocking their shelves, which was obviously not what happened. What happened was people came in there and took everything and it wasn't time for the delivery truck yet.
Right. And I think that there was so much unknown though. So I remember thinking maybe we won't be able to go out, you know, and those kinds of things. And then after a while, people said, no, the food chain is still going to be running and it'll still be running. But there was so much that we didn't know. And
yeah, whole new ball game.
It was at first, it was like, oh, we're going to, you know, I was worn out. I had a really busy January, February, March up to that point. I'm like, oh, we get some time off. And then it sort of hit me, well, it's not going to just sort of pass over, you know, we're going to be inside a house like it's going to pass over. And
right. Put the blood on the lintel and wait. Yeah.
Exactly. And then it's sort of weird. And then someone said too, that she would wake up in the morning and she said it was sort of like someone had died. You know, when you wake up in the morning, you're like, you forget.
Yeah.
And you remember. Yeah. She said it's not as bad, of course, as someone dying. But it sort of is like that, where he's like, wow, this is real.
Something has died.
Yeah.
Can you put a name to it? What is it? Or is it still too soon to define it?
And it's just very weird. And it also, the other day I was watching the news and it looked like those you know, post-apocalyptic movies where they show from all over the world, all the different newscasts, you know, they all show that and that. Today this happened and today, and I said, this is just like a film and we are in it.
Yeah. Pandemic movie with fortunately with no zombies. Yeah.
Right. Right. And, you know, to add the whole economic thing, you know, having no work suddenly. And then, you know, I'm used to working on and off, you know.
Right. Right.
Because the business is.
Most people in the business are. Yeah.
Yeah. It's, you never know.
So do you think that that's what this is like for other, that the pandemic is affecting the local film and television production people in the way that any dry spell has, or is it more profound than that?
Well, it's funny because I've been reading a lot of different blogs and things like that, different groups of people that are thinking about how we're going to get filmmaking back up and running. And people are used to it to a certain extent, but I think, you know, if we knew, if we say, okay, in June, we're going to work again.
Right.
But there's so much unknown.
Yeah. Right.
That's what makes it really different. Although, you know, when the, you know, the whole tax credit thing happened and we were out of work, we still were sort of hoping every day that they would, the government would vote on the budget and we would be back up to work. But it's definitely different because we have this other horrible thing where we could get a virus. Mm-hmm. Or our spouse could get a virus, or, you know, or something, and all that mixed in with it. It's just beyond what anything that we've ever experienced before.
Yeah, pitfalls in every direction.
It's really true.
If you do or you don't. Sheltering at home, in my view, is no impediment to individual creativity. Writers are still writing, actors and singers and dancers and video conferencing classes and performances. Big mouths with medium ideas are launching tiny podcasts. Producers are putting future projects together. Directors are storyboarding and shot plotting page to screen processes. Everybody's working their craft and pacing like racehorses in their stalls, waiting for the gates to burst open. So what are talent and crew opportunities going to be like, do you think, once we do know it's safe again to shoehorn 30 people and a half ton of machinery onto a cramped set?
Well, I think that everybody's really working on that, but it's going to be extremely different.
Do you think that there are ways coronavirus will change the way that we create moving pictures forever?
It's going to be for a while. But I also think in the process of what we're going to have to do to try to keep safe, there will be some changes forever. Like there won't be any craft service. Mm. People eating. The one thing about movie sets, and I was laughing about it yesterday with someone, is that people eat all the time.
On a movie set.
On a movie set.
There's, yes.
You know, a breakfast truck. It's like a diner, man. You can get anything you want. You know, you can just walk up and say, eggs, bacon, da 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 da, and you get everything you want. And then craft service immediately on set, which is all the snacks and coffee and water, anything you can imagine.
All that downtime spent
grazing
stuff in your
people grazing.
That's right.
And then 5 hours later, on the nose, the Teamsters eat, you know. Mm-hmm. 5 hours later, another big meal, and then, you know, more eating all day and grazing, and then they have, you know, a third meal or second meal, they call it, you know, and it just goes on and on. So,
and with people working 12 hours a day and more, and that many of them, there's absolutely no way to assure safe practices that all of them are washing their hands and all the people are touching everything. So it's a petri dish. It's a pandemic waiting to happen in the first place.
It really is. Now, some people are trying to create this sort of lockdown environment. I know they're doing that in Georgia. Mm-hmm. I think Tyler Perry has this whole, you know, studio complex. So he's wants to do something and trying to do something where he's locking down all the actors and the extras and putting them up on the property and those kinds of things to try to sequester everyone and make it safer.
However, are you saying that he's got things in production and he's just keeping everybody?
Yeah, he's starting to prep something that he's shooting in July.
In the Tyler Perry compound? Like they've got razor wire and.
I read that. And so that is a way to help protect for sure, but you're still going to have deliveries. And I think it's really hard to keep everybody safe. And I also think, you know, people are talking about insurance. How are you going to be able to insure productions?
Yeah.
you know.
Oh my goodness.
And but also, how could you ever prove that somebody got sick on a set?
Yeah.
There's no way to prove that, I don't think.
Maybe you can't, so, but the enhanced possibility of that will raise the cost of insuring them.
Right. And also they talked about if someone does get sick, a lot of times people will come to set sick because if they go home, they don't get paid.
Oh yeah.
So one of the things they're trying to implement is that if you do get sick or if you do have a fever and you're sent home, that you will be paid for that time until you get better and come back. So those kinds of things they're talking about. No matter what, it's going to cost more money to produce things, I think. Although there'll be maybe fewer crew people. I don't know.
Maybe we innovate ways to do more things in isolation.
Right. And I do think visual effects companies will be getting lots of work because there's not going to be big crowd scenes for a while.
Mm-hmm.
You're not going to have 500 extras, not even 100 extras on a set.
Yeah.
So they'll have to do a lot of that kind of thing. And, you know, makeup people, hair people, and, you know, these hair makeup trailers where people are all, you know, in this small confined space.
Every movie is going to be Andy Serkis as everything. The motion capture Lon Chaney playing every part.
Yeah. And, you know, someone said, how are you going to do sex scenes? I don't know, you know, that kind of thing. I don't know.
Yeah, right.
6 feet apart. So all of those things, they're trying to figure it out. And
full,
that's all
full body condoms. Yeah.
Yeah. That's all we can do is try to figure it out. And in a positive way, a lot of people are being so negative about it, I think, from things that I've read, instead of saying, well, we can't do this and I'm not doing that. You know, it's just like, okay, well, what can we do to make it safer? What can we do to make you feel more comfortable?
Because yeah,
we have to work.
I'm all for the change. I'm for, you know, I'm innovation minded, I hope, and I'm looking for the silver linings. But before I go to the really positive, I want to ask you, have you lost anybody, or do you know anybody personally who has had COVID-19 or lost a loved one to it?
Luckily, I don't have anybody close to me that has gotten it, but I do know people that have lost. One woman that I know lost both her parents within hours of each other.
Were they living at home, or were in the same care facility? Or?
I think I know that they were in the same hospital room before they died. And I do know people that have had the virus and gotten better.
Yeah. Me too.
One in New York, one in Maine, you know, most people that either lived in New York or they were traveling a lot right before gotten better.
It's true that not everybody has it to the same level of severity. And they know some of the reasons behind that, exposure to higher viral loads generally. But it's Russian roulette. There's a woman, I had just read her blog, the first time she was able to sit in one place and breathe well enough to just write a blog about how sick she'd been. And she's not older. She's a parent, I think, of some small children or maybe middle school children. And she's been sick for 67 days. And for 67 days at that point, she'd spent every day, part of the day at least, or large parts of the day, feeling like she was drowning and just monitoring her blood oxygen levels. And if it gets to a certain nadir, she's got to go to the hospital, but she's not supposed to go otherwise because of the possibility of contaminating other people. And I know a guy who I interviewed, whose son, he caught it and he lived through it, and it was bad, but I think it lasted about 3 weeks for him. But then he had heard that young people don't get it. So he had a 17-year-old son be his sole caretaker, and they sheltered together. Then the son got much sicker, and he was in critical care for over a month, and it was really touch and go. And he had no pre-existing conditions, no respiratory problems, allergies, nothing. And then other people, it seems to be like a flu or even a cold for some people.
Right. And the people that I know that got it were pretty young. And yeah. The two people that I know I'm thinking about now lived by themselves, and they had to take care of themselves. I can't even imagine that.
How old were they?
They're both in their 40s. In their 40s, one in their 50s. To me, that's young.
Yeah, so, it is young.
And, you know, definitely not they didn't really have any preconditions or anything like that. And I just thought, I think that that would be so scary to be by yourself and have to go through that.
Yeah.
And but another good thing is that we do have the internet and, you know, so many ways to communicate now,
mm-hmm.
which makes it a lot more tolerable, I think.
Mixed bag, but yeah, definitely. I'm sure it does make it more tolerable because we don't feel we're virtually connected to so many people.
It's so true. And I've been really trying to reach out to people that I know are living by themselves.
Yeah.
To sort of, you know, check in on them and connect a little bit and make them laugh a little bit, maybe have a cocktail with them, you know?
Yeah, that's going to be a Plague Talk mission. Thank you. Push for that.
And, you know, that's one of the things that I've realized during this time that's just so important to connect with other people.
Yeah. You know, we had a yogi come on and, we're going to have to redo the episode because there were technical problems, but she was the first person to bring to my attention. This is weeks ago that pandemic is pause for some of us, but for others it's accelerator. It's an acceleration of abuse, loneliness, depression, and other things. If you suddenly are cut off from the world.
It's really true. And I think that, you know, we just have to pay attention to that and try to help other people as much as we can get through this.
Well, there is that Mosser personality coming out when she's not in the casting office, coming out in her private life under lockdown, reaching out to those who are alone.
I'm trying. One thing that I wanted to bring up that you mentioned that people are creating is how much music is happening.
Mm.
And, you know, I've been watching so many, we've been listening to so much more music and watching people streaming concerts and things like that, that it's been really helpful.
Yeah. And these videos of people dancing around the world.
The original cast of A Chorus Line was doing
really
the opening number on Zoom and these wonderful choirs singing together. It's just so great.
So what's an average day in your life now?
That's a really good question. Well, we stay up really late. So I have, my husband is here with me and my son who's 19 is home. And we stay up really late watching late night TV and shows on Netflix and Amazon and Hulu and Apple TV.
Yeah.
And
What are you binging?
It's sort of, we watch Homeland. We watched the last season of Homeland. We've watched all the seasons of Homeland. Sunday nights were great. And Outlander. We watched Homeland, then Outlander.
All the lands, yeah.
They are both out for the season. And now we're watching Afterlife.
Is that
with Ricky Gervais?
Yeah, that's good.
Gosh, is he good? He's really good.
Yeah.
And he's a good dramatic actor. I did not realize until watching this how good he is.
He's all right. he's kept me in good humor with his outtakes over the years, I'll tell you that.
Oh wow. That'd be fun to watch.
Oh my god, they're everywhere. Yeah. Spend the night doing that with cocktails.
I will.
But there'll be a lot of spit takes.
What else are you watching? We watch The Morning Show. Early on,
mm-hmm.
We binged that on Apple TV. There's Reese Witherspoon and Jennifer Aniston. Have you seen
The actual, the show called Morning Show.
Oh, yeah.
No, I've heard good things about it. I haven't seen it yet.
Yeah. And Ozark.
Yeah.
Ozark. We just love it.
Yeah, me too. Smart show.
Yes, there's just so much. I have a huge list that we haven't even started on yet. So there's so much wonderful content out there.
Do you find yourselves drinking more than usual?
Oh, definitely. At first, it was sort of like Christmas or something. I was getting all this food.
Right.
All this Christmas type. You know, like, it was like I was going to entertain, in, you know, 20 people in my house.
Uh-huh.
Instead of three of us.
Right.
And we pretty much have a cocktail every night.
Nice.
Or a glass of wine or something. And they just opened up the state stores, a lot of the state stores in Pennsylvania. And my husband called up the other day and did an order over the phone, which is so sort of the old days, you know, when you would call the grocery store and do an order.
Those are even before my time. Yeah.
Yeah.
They're coming into my time now.
Yeah, I remember my mother doing that.
Yeah.
And so he called up and he got this really friendly guy on the phone that really knew his stuff. And the guy was literally walking around the state store with a cart and picking out what anything that Jack wanted. He got $180 worth of alcohol.
They were talking as he did it. They were in communication as he shopped.
Yeah, it was really cute. Because Jack was like, oh yeah, I really like that one. Not the rye, but the bourbon. And you know, they were just chatting away and laughing and it was pretty cool. And then 10 minutes later we went to the store and there was a nice guy standing there with our box and put it in our trunk. And
sweet,
he said, what a nice golden retriever that is. He's a really good, you know. So it was an interesting experience. But
do you go out at all? Do you go out shopping for staples, or have you since this happened?
No.
Okay.
I haven't gone into one store.
Have you been on a walk?
We do walks almost every day.
What's it like?
It's wonderful, especially when the weather was good at first. And when it first happened, the weather got really nice and spring-like, and there were beautiful flowers and trees blooming. And so instead of going to parks, because our local park is usually packed with people, too many people, I think, we started to go to other neighborhoods. We get in the car with our golden retriever and we drive to another neighborhood and we pull over and park and walk and look at all the houses and just sort of explore other neighborhoods. And that's been really fun.
Yeah. Not everybody's adhering to best practices right now, safe practices.
No. And so this way, every once in a while, you see a random person walking their dog, but there's hardly anybody out. So I feel like it's safer to do it that way. And that's been really helpful. I think we're definitely eating too much. I'm cooking like crazy, which I usually don't do, except on holidays. So, you know, making pies and cookies and things that I usually never do.
Have you made anything for the first time?
Not really, but I made beef stroganoff recently, and I can't remember the last time I made that.
I was 17 for the last time I ate it. I've never made it. Yeah.
So a lot of things with pasta and soups and
comfort foods.
A lot of comfort food.
Yeah, we need comfort. There's been a number of articles talking about the collective grief over the sea change that we're facing.
Yeah. Have you
any aha moments? Any life-enriching insights coming out of this?
There are really good things about it. I haven't had, this morning I set an alarm so I could be up for you, but I haven't had to set alarms. And that, it's been so long since I didn't have to set an alarm.
Yeah, I bet.
And that is wonderful. Really wonderful. And I also, as I said before, I just realized that I don't want to be, I'm never going to retire, you know, as it's called retiring.
Yes.
I don't think I could ever really do that because.
Me too.
You know, even though this is different, you know, because when, if you're retired, you can travel, you can, you know. Meet up with people and things like that. But I just really enjoy working and talking to my clients and making them happy, making my clients happy and having a purpose like that. And
yeah, you've been critical to so many projects for so long, right? Just a fulcrum and a touchstone, as the Sweetheart director said, Schabowski.
Yeah. And, you know, it's nice to be needed. It's nice to make money.
You've been in the life for a long time. It's got to be a big vacuum in that way.
That's really true. Although we've been doing little Zoom meetings and things. I did a Zoom seminar for parents that talked about, you know, acting for kids and the whole movie, you know, film and TV business for children. And
good. People show up?
Yeah. They got Zoom? About 15 people.
That's parents. Good.
Yeah. And that was fun. And my husband's teaching a voiceover class for actors, and I was a special guest with that.
Oh, yeah?
And that was so much fun to see these kids. They were seniors at Point Park University, acting majors, and it was so fun just to see their faces and answer their questions, and that was very helpful. But yeah, I'm ready, definitely ready to get back to work whenever that happens.
Yeah, whenever. Who do you turn to living or recorded for wisdom or direction in times of crisis or uncertainty? Is there an author or some relative or some old friend?
I have my best friend since I was born.
What?
She was born in May and I was born in June. Uh-huh. And we lived next to each other, next door neighbors, uh-huh. for years and years. And she's still in central Pennsylvania, living a very different life than mine. But, you know, we're still best friends.
Wow.
So we talk almost every day, either on the phone or FaceTime and things like that. And she's been, it's been really helpful to be able to vent or, you know, commiserate or laugh together. And a lot of friends. I'm calling and talking to a lot of friends that have really been, we're all supporting each other, you know, helping with PPP loan applications and unemployment.
What does PPP stand for?
It's a payroll protection program. And that was to try to help people keep their employees on payroll.
Okay.
So I was able to do that for my one employee because of it, you know, just sort of help each other navigate all those things and just be support in general, especially people that work in my business that have really been shut down.
What do you see as some of the silver linings of the pandemic?
I think hopefully people, I've noticed that people are being a lot nicer to each other. I really think so. Like even, you know, I've had calls from clients, people trying to, you know, get things moving again and asking my advice on how we could do auditions and things like that. And everyone just seems to be a lot nicer. So I hope that continues.
Yeah, it's because we're not commuting.
Yeah, that's part of it too. I think there will be less commuting. I think a lot of companies are going to be like, you know what? You can work at home.
Yeah.
You can stay 4 hours a day and travel in Los Angeles if you stay at home.
That's what I'm hoping people will discover. The data was already there that people who work from home in positions where you can work from home perform a little better than people at their desk in their offices. Partly they think because of their feeling that the employer thinks they won't, that there's this, that they're going to loaf or, you know, take advantage of it. There have been some very obvious benefits environmentally. Some of the lessons of lockdown have even had a mind-changing impact on people I know. For example, I know this a former climate change denier who saw those before and after lockdown pictures of evident air pollution, who did not instantly go to the doctored photos defense, and who now agree that it's possible, even in a short time, for human behavior to have real powerful consequences on the environment. Seismologists have detected less rumbling.
Wow.
There's less air pollution. Cities are much quieter, which is a boon for not a boon for everybody. And I think so may be our oceans. Our oceans may also be a lot quieter right now. So what lessons can we take away from all of these changes and into future film productions to a tent production that's as big as filmmaking? How can we take some of these lessons of work from home and not commuting and being kinder to our planet?
Well, I do think that maybe I know that just in my company, probably we won't be expected to be on set now. And we can, you know, the production assistants can just sign in the extras. We don't need to be there. And, you know, I think that, you know, sort of unnecessary.
Do you foresee Zoom auditions in the future, in your future?
Absolutely. In fact, I was supposed to have one this week and they sort of it was a commercial and they were really in a hurry. And then they sort of realized that they couldn't shoot that quickly for whatever reason. I didn't really know the details, but they said, we would like to do a Zoom audition. We will have the director and producer and the client online watching. And we will decide right after who gets the part. And then we'll just do everything at once. And usually there's a process where we have a first audition and then we have a callback. Or sometimes the client just chooses people from on tape, you know, that we do an audition by ourselves. And that had been happening a lot. Even before this. Directors not wanting or needing to be in the room meeting the actors, which I really like when they actually come and do that. That's really been changing a lot already. So this is going to push that even farther. And you know, my client was like, do you think we could do that? And I said, absolutely. In fact, Zoom has a waiting room so we can assign a time to the actor to sign on to the meeting and to the audition. And then when we're ready for them, we just take them out of the waiting room. And he said, that is so cool. I didn't know we could do that. And I said, I just learned that last week. So, you know,
we're all learning very rapidly how to transition into more virtual.
And I think in the future, you know, I said that, you know, right before this happened, the director is like, why don't we just do a Skype thing? And that's what we did back then with the director. So the director Skyped in and he was there. And so I think that people won't be traveling as much. And we could do a lot more electronically than we even realized before.
Yeah. So we'll cut down on pollution, we'll cut down on expenses, cut down on potential contamination of one another with things like this.
Absolutely. In fact, this agency producer at that last audition I had, he said, I am so much more productive when I work at home.
Mm-hmm.
And I said, really? He said, yeah, he's a writer too. So he said, I think maybe he could just concentrate better when in a quiet place.
Yep.
So I didn't really realize that. And then you mentioned it also. That's an interesting thing to know.
Yeah, I'd see in Los Angeles, all of these writers out. And obviously I was one of them because I was there. I tried it. Some famous places to write, you know, the guy who wrote the story for the movie The Deer Hunter was there. And the guy who created Murphy Brown was there. They're all in this room writing. And but I always feel like I can do it to a degree there, but I need the silence. I need earplugs in or can do some music. And I always wonder if they're partly not just there on display, you know, looking to hook up with somebody who remember how great they are and give them a gig or something.
Right. Another thing I noticed, that I don't think I would like to work at home all the time is I'd like to separate home and work. So
yeah,
I like going to the office and just it's work time, right?
Yeah.
And then coming home, and even though they blend and they bleed and everything, clients are always expecting you to be there for them. Now, I sort of like that. In fact, a few weeks ago, I judged the Trinity Film Festival, and instead of going up to Trinity, they had the film festival online this year. And so all the judges met in a Zoom meeting to discuss who the winners were.
Huh.
And I drove to my office in Lawrenceville. And because I really just wanted to be back at the office in a nice quiet place. I wanted to make sure I had, my husband had a Zoom class online that night. My son was streaming video games. So I was like, I really want to make sure I have the right amount of internet that I need. And I just went to my office and it was so quiet. The street was quiet. The office was quiet. And I could just sort of be in that space. And I realized how much I missed it being there. I've always liked to have a balance. You know, when I work too much, I'm like, I really need to be home. You know, and I like to try to keep it balanced, and this will certainly be balanced the other way for sure.
I hope you get there soon. When and if we get back to a relative norm again, what do you, other than the changes in industry we've talked about, just in the world, what do you want normal to be like then? Do you want anything to be in that to be different? How would you improve it?
I want people to pay attention to how their lives affect other people more. You know, even if it's wearing a mask to protect somebody else, I think that it's really important that we pay attention to other people's needs. And I think it's sort of emphasized, one of the things that this is all emphasized is how people are living paycheck to paycheck, right? Because there was panic very quickly.
Yeah.
And the food line started very quickly, and it sort of made me realize how people are just living in a state of fear pretty much all the time.
Yeah, we can't afford a long derailment in the current system and configuration, unless we agree that we're putting it on pause internationally, really. Because if one country can go full steam ahead and another can't, the one that can't, obviously, is going to fall way behind economically. But if we can all agree to pause, then maybe it could be done for a long period of time. But otherwise, I'm pretty much in that category of living paycheck to paycheck, or have been. And I've often thought, what happens? The place closes down, you can't get another job. What happens? I wasn't thinking in terms of pandemic, although I did know, I had read that super bacteria, super fungi, super viruses are coming. And this is some epidemiologists are saying this is just a dress rehearsal, and it's good that we're having it because it lets us know where the cracks are in the in the system. So hopefully we'll be better prepared when something worse comes. Because it's not, it's not even if they're saying, it's when.
Yeah. And one thing too is that it's been sort of comforting to know that everybody in the world is actually going through the same thing and united in that way. But it's also horrible to know that the entire world is going through it too.
We're not all united in how to deal with it, what measures to take about it.
No, and I'm a little worried because it seems to be getting worse in that, you know, the longer it goes, the people are starting to really, so the ugly side of people is really coming out. So
some of them, yeah, it's hard to, I mean, just, it's not a human feature. Obviously, it's a bug that we can't sit still very long. We have this person of action fallacy in our minds that it's better to do something than nothing. Even if that something kills us, and you know that some people are going to reach a point of critical mass just in their impatience, just in their inability to stay in suspended animation any longer.
Right.
And that's going to manifest as indignation against what they feel is a government trying to control their lives or the world order, whatever they imagine it is. And they're going to, I think, just jump the barriers. Some people.
Yeah, it's also people's ability to cope and whatever that is, and fear and...
Right. We're not all at this on the same point of the spectrum and for any of those things. Hey, thank you. It's always wonderful to spend time with you. You've been a wonderful guest, and I'm looking forward to having people hear what you have to say.
It's always great to talk to you, Jack.
Thanks for listening. If you'd like to be a guest on Plague Talk, or you know somebody who would be a great interview, please contact me through email at jack@plaguetalkpodcast.com. or through the Facebook Plague Talk page, or by using the contract form at plaguetalkpodcast.com. Send pictures of yourself in the lockdown gallery in your work-at-home spaces, and of your fun and joyful moments. And from now on, with your clothes on. If you have ideas for safe and responsible services for those sheltering in place, please post them to our Facebook page or email them to me. And if you know of links to critical helplines, services, support groups, and resources, we'd love to add them to our Smart Links page. Finally, and this is something Nancy brought up during our conversation, if you can think of anybody you know who's out there sheltering at home alone, please find it in your heart and now more leisurely schedule to reach out and let them know you're thinking about them. Until next time, stay safe, keep your distance, don't touch your mask or face, wash those hands, and stay at home, but let the world hear your voice. You've got something to say. We want to hear it. Plague Talk is a brainchild of Smarty Pod. Theme music by Kiyoshi Fujioka.